KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Pakistan says it shot down drones over its big cities. People heard explosions over Lahore. What's the aftermath of India's attacks that it describes as a response to terrorism? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Today, the U.S. and its allies celebrated victory in Europe at the end of World War II. I'm Leila Faldig.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. How are Europeans recalling that moment and reflecting on the way the world has changed? Also, why is Hollywood struggling? And why are Boise and Salt Lake City defying state laws on which flags they can fly? It is Thursday, May 8th, World Red Cross and Red Crescent Day. That's an idea for a day of action which came about after World War I to advance the cause of peace. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says the U.S. has reached a trade deal with the British government. He says there'll be a formal announcement next hour. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports this would be the first trade deal since Trump imposed an array of tariffs on goods worldwide.
In a social media post, Trump described the deal with the United Kingdom as, quote, full and comprehensive. Earlier this year, Trump announced tariffs on goods from most countries, including high tariffs on some major trading partners. He soon paused those, imposing a blanket 10% tariff on most goods, saying he would negotiate tariffs country by country. This agreement with the UK would be the first such deal since those tariffs. Trump said in his post that many other deals are, quote, in serious stages of negotiation. Trump's highest tariffs of 145% are on Chinese goods. China has retaliated with high tariffs on U.S. goods. U.S. and Chinese officials are scheduled to meet this weekend to discuss their trade war. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Catholic cardinals will try again today to select a new pope. For the second day in a row, they sent up black smoke from the Sistine Chapel's chimney at the Vatican. The cardinals will remain in seclusion until a new pontiff is chosen. There have been fresh attacks today between Pakistan and India. Pakistan's army spokesman says his country shot down a dozen Indian military drones that had killed a civilian and injured four Pakistani soldiers. NPR's Amkar Kandekar reports this comes after India's most significant missile attacks on Pakistan in more than 50 years.
Spokesperson Ahmad Sharif says the drones were hovering over major cities, including Rawalpindi, the location of the Pakistani army headquarters.
This is a serious provocation.
The latest accusations come after India struck multiple targets across Pakistan on Tuesday in what it says is retaliation for a militant attack in late April, where gunmen killed 26 people. Pakistan denies any connection to that attack and says it will defend itself. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
The sex crimes trial of former film mogul Harvey Weinstein continues today in New York. In this retrial, a new accuser has taken the witness stand against Weinstein. Ilya Meritz has this report.
Prosecutors say Kaya Sokola was about 20 years old when Weinstein assaulted her in a hotel in 2006. It's one of three criminal counts against him. On the witness stand, Sokola described winning a modeling competition in her native Poland at just 14 years old, and soon traveling to Paris and New York for work. She'll be back on the stand Thursday. Six female accusers testified at Weinstein's first New York trial in the year 2020, but only three are expected this time, and Sokola is the only new accuser the jurors will hear from. Weinstein maintains he's innocent. His previous conviction was overturned on procedural grounds. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meritz in New York.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Police in New York detained scores of demonstrators at Columbia University yesterday. The pro-Palestinian demonstrators were protesting the war in Gaza. They took over a library. Columbia University says two officers were injured in the incident. Some video indicates the protesters damaged some library structures. The Trump administration has targeted international students at several universities in the U.S. who have criticized Israel or been in pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Weight Watchers has filed for bankruptcy protection. The international company is built on providing social support in losing weight. But NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports it is burdened with debt as customers turn to more weight loss medications.
Weight Watchers was started by a housewife struggling with overeating in the 1960s. It gained a worldwide following, using a method to track food intake using a point system and encouraging members to attend regular support meetings to stay on track. But in recent years, the company struggled to keep up as new obesity medications like Wegovy and Zepbound entered the market. Weight Watchers hopes to shed over $1 billion in debt in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy while it continues operations. The company is trying to pivot by focusing more on offering telehealth prescriptions for the newer drugs. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
The Michigan State House has passed a measure offering $100 million in aid to the state's Upper Peninsula. It was hit with a major ice storm in March. Some people lost power for 2 weeks. Millions of Michigan trees were broken in half. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, we go to St. Peter's Square, where people wait for cardinals to choose a new pope.
First, blasts heard over Pakistan's second largest city signal the most recent salvo in a generations-long conflict in South Asia.
This morning, residents in Pakistan's second largest city of Lahore were hearing explosions. Pakistan's military spokesman, Lieutenant General Ahmad Sharif, says Pakistan shot down Indian drones, which he says were flying over major cities.
This naked aggression continues, and the armed forces are on high degree of alert and neutralizing them as we speak. This is a serious, serious provocation.
Let's remember here, India launched multiple strikes against Pakistan on Tuesday. These were considered the most extensive attacks that India has carried out in more than 50 years. India says it was responding to terror attacks last month that were launched out of Pakistani territory.
On the line with us is NPR's Dia Hadid. She's in Mumbai and covers both India and Pakistan. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So Dia, just bring us up to speed. What is happening today?
Right. Well, the Pakistani Army spokesman, Lieutenant General Ahmad Sharif, accused India of sending across 25 Israeli-made drones this morning. He says some of them flew over major population centres, including Karachi, which is the biggest city in the country with 20 million people, and crucially, Rawalpindi, which is home to Pakistan's general military headquarters. Sharif says they shot down all the drones, except for one that targeted an old airport in Lahore. He says four military personnel were injured and one civilian killed. Sharif just spoke to the media in English. That's a signal that his message is for the West.
It appears that India has apparently lost the plot. And rather than going on a path of rationality, is further escalating in a highly charged environment. To satisfy the hubristic mindset of the Indian government.
What he's referring to there, Leila, is India's Hindu nationalist government, which had vowed retribution for a militant attack in late April, where gunmen opened fire on tourists in a meadow, killing 26. India blamed Pakistan for that attack. Pakistan says it's not connected, but it's that incident which triggered these escalations.
Right, but I'm thinking, where does this go? It seems like tensions are just rising and rising at this point.
At this point, yes, but if I can step back a bit, when India struck Pakistan earlier this week, the Indian military had quickly signaled they were not seeking an escalation. And Pakistan said it shot down 5 Indian military aircraft. And analysts told me they were waiting to see if that would be enough for Pakistan to show its people that the army was defending the country. Even this morning, the Pakistani Deputy Prime Minister confirmed that national security advisers of both countries had spoken to each other, so it was looking hopeful. But then the accusation happened of India sending drones over Pakistani airspace. So Ajay Shukla, he is a retired Indian Army colonel, and he says any new development here changes all calculations.
And the dynamic between those two are sort of hostile and sort of aggressive, then what Waterson said 2 days ago no longer holds good. There is absolutely a scope for something bigger.
Has India said anything about these allegations about the drones?
Not so far, but India's foreign minister has just said if the country is attacked, there'll be a firm response. And it's important to remember already in this latest escalation, there are casualties, more than 30 people on the Pakistani side, including children, and more than 12 people killed in India. And that doesn't even include the 26 people who were killed by gunmen in late April, which triggered this whole escalation.
That's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Thank you, Dia.
Thank you, Leila.
Trying to keep it all straight here, we heard Pakistan say it shot down drones over its cities. India now confirms they did attack Pakistan and says their attack was aimed at Pakistan's air defense systems. India says it was responding to Pakistani attacks. We also have reports of artillery fire going back and forth across the line of control, with India saying that some civilians were killed on their side, too. Praveen Danti is going to help us sort through this. He's a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group, currently in New Delhi. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We just heard Dia Hadid say India struck earlier in the week. We had the impression that would be it. National security advisors talking, trying to work it out, but suddenly more strikes today. What do you make of that?
Well, it portends a serious escalation that's going to, you know, occur in the next few days and weeks, maybe. You know, the very first round of escalation between India and Pakistan has started on a much larger scale than the last crisis in 2019.
Right.
So that's a cause for concern. And probably it was in 1971 when both the nations went to a full-fledged war that we've seen these kind of exchanges.
Wow. So you're telling me that there are multiple wars have been fought between these countries, but nothing major for more than a generation. And now you see this. I'm just thinking this through. India says we're striking air defenses in Pakistan. Let's assume that's true for purposes of this question. When you strike air defenses, it is often to clear the way for hitting something else, to clear out the airspace. Is there an expectation that India could strike yet again?
Well, they say it's an ongoing operation. They've already claimed to have hit 9 sites, which they call terror infrastructure. So more strikes could be on the way. And Pakistan is bound to retaliate and retaliate strongly because they are under immense public pressure, because this time around there have been civilian casualties unlike the last time.
I want to sort through what you think India's objective is. And of course, India says we're responding to this terror attack from April, and we believe it was launched from Pakistani soil. That's the rationale for these strikes. But as they go on day by day, you have to wonder, what's the end state? What are they trying to gain here?
It's in Kashmir since 2019, which has been a heavy-handed security approach hasn't worked, which led to this gruesome attack on 22nd April. India hasn't really provided any hard evidence so far, so it's been under immense public pressure to show something, do something, and India has resorted to these strikes, which seems to have placated the Indian public.
I'm interested in listening to you, because you told me that India may have struck partly because of public pressure to do something. And now Pakistan is under pressure to strike back in some dramatic way because of public pressure to do something.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there have been tit-for-tat diplomatic moves followed by military strikes. And every time there seems to be a demand for a more forceful strike. We don't know what's going to come next, but this time around it looks very serious, but the world seems to be not taking it seriously. President Trump talked about how this conflict has been going on for many decades, you know, many, in fact, he said centuries, which might make it sound like it's a benign war that's been going on and they're bound to stop at one point, but that carries a big risk, huge risk, because both are nuclear powers and all it takes is a miscalculation or a mistake. So both these powers are not completely in control of the escalation dynamics, which the world seems to believe. So there lies the risk.
In the few seconds that we have, what leverage, if any, does the United States have if it chose to use it to try to bring some calm?
It's only the United States which can actually put an end to these hostilities, which it did successfully in 2019. Because power really works. You know, there have been other friendly nations from the Middle East who've been trying to mediate, but that's not going to really work unless the U.S. steps in with full sincerity.
Because the United States is trying to be close to India and has some historic ties with Pakistan, that's why it has to be the U.S.?
Yeah, exactly. President Trump claimed to be close to both the powers, which we know is true, though India and U.S. has been growing closer in the past 10 years. But there are historic ties with Pakistan as well. And ultimately, the U.S. is the superpower who can bring both the parts to the table.
Praveen Danti, senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The world is watching the Vatican this morning as 133 cardinals work to choose which of them will be the next pope. Black smoke rose again earlier today from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel, indicating no pope has been chosen yet. NPR's Ruth Sherlock takes us to St. Peter's Square.
It's extremely unlikely that there will be white smoke this early on, but nonetheless, St. Peter's Square is full of people. One thing you notice, this is a very religious crowd. There's priests, nuns, monks.
I came to evoke the Holy Spirit.
Vicente Goes is a Jesuit student of philosophy in Rome, and he says people haven't come because they think a pope will be elected so quickly.
The majority of the people, there's a feeling of the need to pray, because this is a time where we are with this sensation of vertigo. We are in the hands of God.
Everybody's got excited, they've got their phones out. The big screens here in St. Peter's Square have zeroed in on the chimney. There's a seagull on the chimney with a prime view.
The most famous seagull in the world right now.
Lisa Malfatti has come all the way from California for the conclave.
It's meaningful for the world because we are at a turning point with Catholicism.
With many people in the West turning away from the faith, as we speak, the hours pass, way past the time the results of this first vote were expected. People sing.
Every time the seagull comes back, the crowd claps and laughs. And now they're clapping also to try to send a message. Please send this smoke. Even the priests are starting to look tired.
Until eventually,
there you have it. It's hard to tell in the darkness, but it is black smoke. Today is not the day the Catholic Church gets its new pope.
Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, St. Peter's Square, the Vatican.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Amanda Hess explores how technology now shapes every aspect of parenting, from online identities to the pressure of sharing our lives in real time. She's written a new book about it called Second Life, Having a Child in the Digital Age. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From imaginable futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Jury selection in the trial of music mogul Sean Combs, also known as P. Diddy, began this week. He's pleaded not guilty to charges of sex trafficking, racketeering, conspiracy. Prosecutors allege that Combs' famous parties often devolved into group sex parties where some guests were coerced into taking drugs and sexually assaulted. But while the accusations against Combs are particularly sensational and disturbing, his arrest last year has sparked a lot of discussion about whether the alleged behavior is actually that unusual in the industry. Ty Stichlorius has been part of that conversation. She's one of the top female executives in music. John Legend, for example, is one of the people she works with, and she's written about what she says needs to change, and she's with us now to tell us more about that. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm happy to be here.
You actually wrote about your experience at a party thrown by Combs when you were just out of college. Now, I know this was a long time ago, and I know it's not easy to talk about, but would you just briefly say what happened?
Yes, I was in my early 20s, and I went to a party thrown by Sean Combs. It was on a very large yacht. I had heard that there was a dance party down somewhere in the yacht, and this man who was a colleague of Sean's told me that he could take me there, and he led me into a bedroom and then locked the door behind me. And I just remember being terrified, but I want to be clear, that wasn't just one bad night, that was the culture.
First of all, I just want to let people know, as you report in your piece, and it was as a guest essay in the New York Times, you were able to talk your way out of that situation. Yeah. So very glad of that. But you also wrote, you do now know, after 20 years as a music industry executive, that what happened that night was no aberration. It was an indicator of a pervasive culture in the music industry that actively fostered sexual misconduct and exploited the lives and bodies of those hoping to make it in the business. It's a pretty damning thing to say that this isn't actually an isolated thing.
Well, I mean, if you think about the tagline for music for a long time, it's been sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a story and a case about how power has operated in the music industry. And I think we need to be careful not to isolate this to one man or one case, because those of us who've worked in the business, sadly, don't find this all that surprising. It's about a system that for decades allowed certain men to operate with total impunity.
Why does this persist? I mean, is it because, in part, so much business is done in non-traditional places, like, you know, meetings and hotel rooms and places like that? You know what I mean? Why? A lot of people who don't work in these fields just think, what's going on here?
Well, you're right to talk about the casting couch. In the music business, that's the recording studio. Unfortunately, I think many of the people who controlled who was in those spaces used it as a way to exploit. I mean, when I was first trying to get a job in the music business, every interview, which ended up being some kind of dinner, was a key card in my hand at the end of the night. Like,
wait, hold on. What do you mean a key card? You mean somebody putting their hotel card in?
Oh, yeah.
Basically implying you're supposed to go and have sex with them.
Exactly. And after that happened 3 separate times, I actually gave up on the music business. I thought, this isn't where I want to be.
As I mentioned that we started with talking about the essay that you wrote for the New York Times back in October when Sean Combs was first arrested, you got a lot of comments. And a number of women wrote and said they gave up on the music industry because they just could not take all of the harassment. I was curious how you felt when you saw that.
Yes, I was surprised how many women who are actually still in the music business reached out to me and said, I've never told my story. I'm afraid if I do, I'll be fired. And these are women in positions of power. I think part of it is we have to talk about NDAs.
Non-disclosure agreements.
Yes. I think they play a huge role. I know many men and women who've been threatened with the end of their careers if they spoke up. NDAs have been signed and they're signing away their truth in exchange for basic rights like song ownership or fair pay. That silence wasn't consent. It was survival.
Do you think that record labels are really willing to let somebody go who's talented because they're abusive?
I unfortunately have not seen proof of that. You know, I've reported abuses and it's a very polite thank you. And then they hung up the phone and I see very few consequences come from it. You look at how long it took R. Kelly and P. Diddy to be held accountable. That's the part that bothers me, is that people have not stood up for something better. And I think we need to change that.
Ty Stiklourios is the CEO and founder of Friends at Work. That's a management firm, and she's one of the highest ranking women in the music industry. Thanks so much for talking with us. Very sobering.
Thank you, Michelle.
The City Council in Boise, Idaho made a decision. Leaders of Salt Lake City, Utah made that decision too. Both cities will continue flying pride flags. Both are working around state laws that limit what kinds of banners can be flown on city properties. Here's Julie Lukata of Boise State Public Radio.
In February, Idaho's legislature passed a law prohibiting non-official flags from being flown on government property. But this week, Boise's City Council passed a resolution making the pride flag an official city flag, allowing it to be flown at city buildings. About 100 people, mostly supporters, rallied in front of City Hall before the vote. Boise City Council member Meredith Stead said the city had flown the pride flag for a decade, and removing it would not be a neutral gesture.
It would signal a retreat from values we've long upheld and send a disheartening message to those who have found affirmation and belonging through its presence at City Hall.
Melody Osman protested the vote outside, saying the pride flag was divisive and did not represent the majority of residents.
It's about government spaces trying to remain neutral and supporting and being a voice for everyone, not just a select few.
In April, Idaho's Republican Attorney General sent Boise's mayor a letter urging her to comply with the state's ban on unofficial flags. He said the city could be denied state funds if she didn't. As currently written, the law does not have specific penalties for breaking it. On the same day, Salt Lake City's council okayed flying the Pride, Transgender, and Juneteenth flags at city buildings. They added a city symbol, the sago lily, to each of the banners. That, the council believes, will allow them to comply with a state law similar to Idaho's ban on unofficial flags. For NPR News, I'm Julie Lugeta in Boise.
This is NPR News.
World War II ended in Europe 80 years ago today. That anniversary resonates with NPR's Bob Mondello, who recently found some long-forgotten letters his mother saved from her time working with the Red Cross.
Guy. I met him at the Corso Club, June 17, 1945. He plays ping pong, but I beat him.
Bob Mondello remembers his mother. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. This is day two of the papal conclave at the Vatican, where more than 130 Roman Catholic cardinal electors are meeting behind closed doors to select a successor to Pope Francis. Two rounds of voting have resulted in black smoke coming from a chimney atop the Sistine Chapel, signaling the process will continue. White smoke would confirm a new pope has been chosen. President Trump says the U.S. has reached a trade agreement with the United Kingdom. The president is expected to provide more details at a White House news conference next hour. NPR's Lauren Freyer in London says this is the first such trade agreement since Trump imposed sweeping tariffs.
Britain had been lobbying the White House for relief from U.S. tariffs on British steel, cars, and the British film industry. It had also been looking for a carve-out for any future U.S. tariffs on British pharmaceuticals. The U.S., in turn, had been asking for relief from a digital sales tax the U.K. imposed on e-commerce firms like Amazon. This may be Trump's first trade deal since what he called Liberation Day, when he imposed tariffs on most foreign imports into the U.S. But for the U.K., it's also part of an effort to strike new post-Brexit trade deals. Since Britain left the European Union 5 years ago, it's been negotiating new trade rules with individual countries, and it signed a deal with India earlier this week. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News from Washington. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is among officials from the Trump administration preparing for high-level talks with a delegation from China. They're slated to meet this weekend in Geneva, Switzerland. Bessent has described the talks as a precursor to potential negotiations over trade and tariffs. The FAA says it's taking steps to increase safety at Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey. This follows days of flight delays and cancellations, as NPR's Jacqueline Diaz reports.
Newark Airport has been dealing with major flight delays and cancellations. And last week, air traffic controllers briefly lost all communications with a plane. Now, FAA officials are making changes aimed at addressing the problems. So far, the FAA has slowed down arrivals and departures as the airport continues to have a shortage of air traffic controllers. And three new high-bandwidth telecommunications connections are being installed. Agency officials believe that will improve speed and reliability, and old copper telecoms wires will be replaced with fiber optic cables. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
The Academy of Country Music Awards will be handed out tonight in Frisco, Texas. Ella Langley leads the field of entertainers with 8 nominations. Cody Johnson, Lainey Wilson, and Morgan Wallen have 7 each. Chris Stapleton has 6. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. 80 years ago today, in 1945, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill made an announcement. Nazi Germany had surrendered.
Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight.
This was known as Victory in Europe Day, or VE Day. It marked the end of World War II in Europe, although Japan in the Pacific would not surrender for some months more. Today, there are memorials and moments of silence across Europe, as well as fears for Europe's security, which has depended ever since on arrangements made at the end of that war. NPR's Lauren Freyer is in London. Hey there, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
What's the scene in Europe?
So the day began in London with a memorial service at Westminster Abbey. There's a nationwide moment of silence and tea parties this afternoon. Hmm. Pubs are open 2 hours late tonight so that you can raise a glass to what Americans call the greatest generation. It's been a week of VE Day events here. They began Monday with a military parade, and here's what it sounded like. King Charles stood at attention, saluting troops and cavalry in those furry black hats and red coats. Royals and politicians were seated on a parade stand mixed in with World War II veterans, many of them with walking sticks and wheelchairs.
I think all holidays should have a tea party and pubs open 2 hours
totally.
Late. And it's a reminder, this is a celebration of a happy moment, although also a somber moment, because so many millions of people were killed in the war, but it ended on this day. What kinds of scenes are there across Europe?
There's a wreath-laying ceremony in Paris tonight, but as you say, it's a more somber day, especially in Germany. I asked a German historian, Katja Hoyer. She says May 8th is celebrated there as a day of liberation.
The German people were liberated by the Allies from their own regime, from Nazism. But this concept also exonerates ordinary Germans to a degree, because the concept of liberation implies that they were held captive by their own Nazi regime and then were liberated by it rather than having supported it in the first place.
She says Germans are still struggling with the idea of taking responsibility for, because, you know, many of them supported the Nazis during those years.
Okay, so how do new threats to Europe's security factor into these commemorations today?
Ukrainian soldiers actually marched in that military parade I played you the sound of there, and King Charles saluted them as well as the British troops. There is a sense across Europe that the post-World War II order is crumbling. I spoke to a historian at Oxford University, Timothy Garton Ash, and he says there are three big threats to Europe today.
The war in Ukraine is by far the largest war in Europe since 1945. Countries like China and India and Turkey, and we're in a post-Western world, if you like. And then with President Donald Trump, we Europeans feel we can no longer rely on the US security umbrella on which we've relied for most of this 80 years.
So he says this is a really critical moment. And he says, you know, just 5 years ago, the 75th anniversaries of VE Day were really like a celebration. And even though they were under COVID lockdown then, now just 5 years later, the 80th anniversary is really tinged with fear, threats, and a feeling of abandonment from the United States.
What's the scene in Russia, which was also on the winning side 80 years ago?
In Russia, it's called Victory Day, and it's celebrated tomorrow, because when Churchill said at midnight, that was actually the next day in Russia's time zones. So there will be a big parade in Red Square tomorrow. Russia says dozens of world leaders are attending, including China's Xi Jinping and Brazil's Lula da Silva.
And NPR's Lauren Frayer, thanks.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration wants to send migrants to Libya, possibly as soon as this week.
Libya. U.S. officials have spent the last few months negotiating with various countries to see who is willing to take in people deported from the United States.
NPR's immigration reporter Ximena Ostillo joins us now to talk about all this. Good morning, Ximena.
Good morning.
So what do we know about this plan to send migrants to Libya?
Yesterday, my colleague Tom Bowman confirmed administration officials are planning to use Libya as a destination for migrants removed from the U.S. Rwanda's foreign minister also said it was in talks with Washington about the same issue. And of course, the U.S. has had similar deals already with Mexico and El Salvador. Now, the deportations to Libya would be carried out by the U.S. military, but it's not clear how many people or what nationalities would be sent under the deal. President Trump told reporters yesterday he didn't know about the plan and to ask the Department of Homeland Security. Homeland Security did not respond to NPR's requests to confirm the plans.
Okay, so we've already seen actions in court to try and stop these military flights before they've even happened. What can you tell us about the lawsuit?
A judge in Massachusetts already issued an injunction blocking the Homeland Security Department from removing migrants to these third countries. That means deporting people to countries they're not originally from. The administration has found workarounds, though. They've used other agencies, such as the Defense Department, to remove people from the U.S. Immigration lawyers filed an emergency motion yesterday asking that same judge to again block removals to Libya or any third country. They argued their clients, who are Laotian, Vietnamese, and Filipino could be sent in a matter of hours. And last night, the judge issued another order. It clarifies DHS can't use a loophole and that any agencies, including the Pentagon, can't deport people to these third countries unless those people get prior time to contest their removals.
Okay, so there's a legal block in this court. I mean, Libya is not considered the safest country. Have other concerns been raised about this plan?
Mm-hmm. First off, Libya has been wrestling with violence and armed conflict since the civil war that toppled Muammar Gaddafi almost 15 years ago. The country is still in turmoil. There's a military strongman who controls the eastern half of the country, and a UN-backed government controls the west. And I'd note both governments issued statements rejecting the plan to send migrants there. And Libya has a notorious human rights record.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the first deal, though, that the White House has made with other countries. We've already reported a lot on the U.S. paying El Salvador $6 million to house migrants removed from the U.S. in a mega prison there. What's the point of these agreements?
One of the main goals is to send migrants further away to avoid people crossing back over U.S. borders. And that's according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Mm. But there are plenty of practical implications. About 1.4 million people have pending deportation orders. That's according to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. But there are many challenges to sending them back to their home countries. One is that their home countries may not agree to accept them or actually have limits on how many people or flights they will take from the United States. And this has created challenges for past administrations because it means that even if someone has a final removal order, they may not actually be removed. But Trump's goal is to increase the pace of deportations, and that does mean finding more places for people to go. If Libya isn't on the table, others likely will be.
NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Tennis writer Christopher Clary's new book tells the story of Spanish superstar Rafael Nadal, his humble origins, his record-breaking success. Next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Pro Hockey's Utah Hockey Club finally has a new name. Team ownership took more than a year and went through four rounds of community voting to come up with this name, sort of like picking a pope. And the new name is the Utah Mammoth. Mammoth, singular, takes its inspiration from the mammoths who lived and roamed across what is now Utah. So Mammoth makes total sense. Sadly, the Lakers were already taken. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. 2 years after writers and actors went on strike, Hollywood is still struggling to recover the resulting job losses in film and television production. Add to that the most expensive wildfires in California's history and a shrinking industry, and you got not as much show or biz happening in Hollywood. While President Trump says he wants to turn it all around with 100% tariffs on all films produced outside the U.S., many writers and producers are leaving the business altogether to a so-called creator economy, a growing field where people are producing digital content on their own terms and opting out of traditional Hollywood. That includes Amy Suto, an author and content creator. She told me about how she got her start in a talent agency as a starry-eyed graduate of USC's film school, which has churned out top Hollywood talent.
From there, I started moving up the ladder and going from assistant to writer assistant to showrunner assistant, and then eventually getting my own episode of TV. And when I was making that jump up the ladder, sometimes I was able to do really exciting things, but oftentimes you're answering phones, you're, you know, going on coffee runs for your boss. And there was a lot more politics than I had anticipated, with a lot more kind of power dynamics between the different hierarchies.
But isn't that just a part of Hollywood? I mean, isn't that just a part of how it is?
You'd think that, but I think the real issue is that as I was continuing on my career in Hollywood, there was becoming this shift as there was becoming fewer and fewer TV shows produced. There was becoming more and more kind of like short order streaming. The writers' rooms were going from 24 episodes to 6 episodes. But because there aren't these longer episodes, there's a lot less ability for writers to grow on these shows. And there's a lot less ability to kind of foster that kind of dynamic magic that happened in writers' rooms more in the early golden age of television, which had its flaws as well, but had more opportunity.
Did you ever feel like your creativity was being squashed?
Yeah, it's part of the reason why I started in between shows doing freelance memoir ghostwriting and writing my own books, because I started to realize that the projects that I was most creatively enlivened by were happening outside of Hollywood and outside of the industry. And my writing was being more valued by people outside of the industry than the people in it. And I just saw that there wasn't a creative future for people who wanted to not write the next Marvel film.
Are you able to stay afloat with what you're doing?
Yes, but in order to make writing your job, you actually do need to have a few different income streams. You know, writing on Substack is something a lot of people are doing. And self-publishing books is something that allows you to kind of bypass gatekeepers and be able to create books and put them out there on your own way. Since I left Hollywood, I've made way more than I've made any time that I was in the industry.
Recently, President Trump announced 100% tariffs on all films produced outside the U.S. Do you think that this kind of a move would help Hollywood, would help the industry?
I don't think so, because when it comes to the production side of things, Hollywood's always had different places it's gone to reduce costs and to be able to, you know, do on-location shoots in different countries. Like, I do think that that is an important part of Hollywood, to be able to have production happen elsewhere. If Hollywood really wants to shift and change, it needs to look inwards about how it treats its creatives and also how it structures its business with gatekeepers and making things for audiences that aren't just another big, you know, superhero franchise. And so taking risks on smaller creative projects and more of like the mid-level films that we used to see a lot of, kind of like undoing a little bit of what streaming broke, will also help the industry. But thinking about what is the way forward with different technologies and how to make things on a budget, but are more respecting of the artists that are coming in for the creative process, that are bringing their humanity to these stories that need to be told.
That's writer and content creator Amy Suto. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. 3 years ago, almost to the day, a renowned Palestinian-American journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, was shot and killed as she covered an Israeli raid in the Palestinian city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. She was a reporter for Al Jazeera, and she wore a clearly marked blue flak jacket with the word press when she was killed. At the time, President Biden vowed to get to the bottom of her killing.
The United States will continue to insist on a full and transparent accounting of her death and will continue to stand up for media freedom everywhere in the world.
Today, no one has been held accountable. A review by the U.S. government determined it was likely an Israeli soldier who killed Abu Akleh. It also concluded it was a tragic mistake. But a group of journalists reveal in a new documentary called Who Killed Shireen that the initial findings of that inquiry told a very different story. That documentary from the media company Zateo is out now. I spoke with Dion Nissenbaum, one of the journalists involved and an executive producer of the film.
We were able to find a key U.S. official to talk to us who told us that U.S. personnel went to the scene in the West Bank city of Jenin where Shireen was killed to try and figure out what happened. And their initial assessment was that the Israeli soldier intentionally targeted Shireen.
It was an indication that it was an intentional killing of, at this point, I'm Shireen Abu Akleh. They would have absolutely known that it was a media person, or not combatant at a minimum, that that person shot and killed her.
In the film, as you can hear, the former U.S. official's voice is distorted. NPR's Daniel Estrin also spoke to that former U.S. official, who also requested anonymity from us to discuss sensitive internal government discussions. The official said the U.S. initially found that the killing was intentional, that the soldier would have known he was shooting at a journalist. But he said those findings were changed, and ultimately the U.S. concluded there was no reason to believe the shooting was intentional. Again, Dion Nissenbaum.
That initial assessment was essentially overruled by the Biden administration, and they came out and said explicitly that it was unintentional.
So what did you make of that when you heard that?
For me, one of the main reasons I wanted to do this documentary is that so many people just don't understand what happened to Shireen that day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Israeli investigation itself concluded that it was very likely that an Israeli soldier falsely identified Shireen as a militant and intentionally killed her. That really is not in debate. There were no militants near her that they were aiming for. She was not caught in any crossfire. The Israeli investigation itself concluded that the soldier intentionally shot her.
Did you find Shireen's killer?
We did find Shireen's killer. He was a 20-year-old soldier who was on his first combat deployment in the West Bank. And we were able to track him down. And he actually was himself killed in Jenin last summer. So he was killed in the city where he killed Shireen.
And how did you confirm that this was actually the person that fired the bullet? Did you reach out to the IDF, to his family?
We have reached out. We confirmed it with Israeli soldiers that knew him and served with him. And we have spoken with the Israeli military about this at length. The Israeli military is declining to comment on this. I can tell you with, you know, high confidence we have identified the shooter.
You know, there are, and you note this in your documentary too, that the Committee to Protect Journalists has documented upward of 176 journalists and media workers, and they determine and allege at least 17 of those journalists and two media workers were directly targeted by Israeli forces. CPJ's classifying them as murders. Why focus on this killing?
Well, her killing was in some ways, you know, the beginning of a trajectory for the Israeli military. Before Shireen, Israel was never on the list of most dangerous countries for journalists. And now, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Israel is considered the most dangerous country for journalists because of what's happening in Gaza. And two more Gaza journalists were killed in new strikes in Gaza. And so you've just see a real shift in the way the Israeli military looks at journalists, and it's becoming ever more dangerous for journalists to work there.
And since her killing, six other Americans have been killed in Israeli fire.
That's right. As we note in the documentary, there are folks like Senator Chris Van Hollen who do believe that the Biden administration's failure to hold Israel to account and get them to change the way they operate did lead to the death of other Americans in the West Bank.
What do you hope this film will achieve?
I'm hoping that it will lead to some reflections from the Israeli military about the way that they operate in the West Bank around civilians and journalists. I'm hoping that the U.S. government will reflect on its own responsibility and trying to seek some justice for an American citizen who was killed by the Israeli military. I hope there's some reflection from U.S. officials about ways that they can stand up for Americans in that situation.
Diane Nissenbaum is one of the executive producers of the documentary Who Killed Shireen? It's out now on Zateo. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you, Leila.
The Israeli military told NPR it does not deliberately target journalists. It also says some of the journalists and media workers documented by the Committee to Protect Journalists were Hamas operatives and therefore lawful targets. We asked the Israeli military for a response to the findings in this documentary. They said in a statement, Zateo has decided to publish the name of the soldier who fell during an operational activity, despite the family's request not to publish the name. And even though they were told there is no definitive determination regarding the identity of the individual responsible for the shooting that caused the journalist's death. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Stephen.
Have you ever passed the corner of 4th and Grand, where a little ball of rhythm runs a shoeshine stand? People gather round and they clap their hands. He's a great big bundle of joy. He pops a boogie-woogie rag, the Chattanooga shoeshine boy. He charges you a nickel just to shine one shoe. Makes the oldest kind of leather look like new. Feel as though you want to dance when he gets through. He's a great big bundle of joy.